What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm Connor Boyle. On today's show, Andrea Elliott, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer and New York Times investigative reporter, discusses her new book, A Portrait of Poverty in New York, Invisible Child. Poverty and how to alleviate it in a country where capitalism is king is a divisive issue in the US. Recent statistics suggest that low-income Americans' life expectancy sits around 15 years less than the country's most wealthy. Troubling figures like these make the work of our guest today, the journalist and author Andrea Elliott, all the more relevant. Her book, Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival and Hope in New York City, focuses on Desarney Coates, a youngster moving from homeless shelter to homeless shelter with her tight-knit family. It might be her book debut, but Andrea is no stranger to crafting vital storytelling, having received the Pulitzer Prize in 2007 for feature writing. Our host today is the novelist Alex Preston, author of titles including Love and War and his new title, Win Chelsea. Here's Alex with more.
Andrea, it's an enormous pleasure to speak to you again, and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I couldn't be happier to be in dialogue with you.
So this is, at its heart, the story of one child in New York City. And I wonder if you could maybe start by introducing us to Desarney and her extraordinary family.
Yes. So I met Desarney standing outside of a homeless shelter. I was there as a reporter for the New York Times in October of 2012. And she walked out of the shelter with her siblings and her mother, and she just immediately struck me as a kind of electrifying presence. She had a lot to say. She was rambunctious. She was just a very spirited child. She was kind of just exudes. She, at that time, sort of popping with enthusiasm and promise. She was on the honor roll. She was the fastest sprinter on the block. She had big dreams and a big agenda, it seemed. And what wasn't immediately apparent in just engaging with her was how hard her actual life was. And it was the contrast of those two things, of her huge aspirations for herself and the reality of being crammed in one room with nine family members, often struggling with food insecurity. Hunger is the more blunt way to put it. Mice running around her room, constant parenting burdens placed upon her because her parents were overwhelmed. It was stunning to me that she could kind of balance those two things. I don't even think it was about balancing. It's that those two facts were just a part, they coexisted inside of her, and they were a part of who she was, that she wanted more, she wanted to transcend, and yet this was her life and she was showing up for it. And it was in a city that was so wealthy, right?
Well, that's one of the things. But Andrea, maybe just give us a little flavor of the book.
Okay, I'm going to read you a passage that comes about three quarters of the way through. This is a book that follows Desarney as she grows up. So I was in her life for 8 years with her family and saw a lot of ups and downs. She came of age in that time. And one of the most difficult things about being deeply poor in New York City is that you have to survive all these government systems that can be generous and can also be very punishing. And so I'm going to show you a quick photograph. This is Desarney and her closest sister of the seven siblings, Aviana, in the background. They were both named for bottled water. Aviana, Desarney. They were born 11 months apart and they were just like twins. This was taken in 2012 when I began.
So, Andrea, just tell us exactly how old Desarney is in the photo there.
In the photo, she is 11, and her sister behind her, Aviana, is 10. And they consider themselves, quote unquote, full blood sisters. They had this, you know, they shared the same pillow, the same mattress, the same dresser drawer. They had secret handshakes. It was that unspoken language of siblings that they had. And
but they're almost like twins, aren't they? They describe themselves as twins
at some point. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. They did. They thought of themselves as twins. And they did not consider themselves as separate individuals, as far as I could tell, until Child Protection Services intervened and separated all the children from their parents because the parents were being accused of providing inadequate housing to the children. It wasn't that they were abusing them. And these kids were placed in a foster care system that did give them housing, but did not give them the thing they always had at home, which was love. 2 years after that, so 5 years after this photograph was taken, their bond, which was always so deep, is on the verge of being broken. And this is the scene. Dasani's in a foster home in Staten Island, a different part of New York. "Forever family," writes Dasani on December 3rd, 2017, above a photograph on Facebook showing three new friends. They are throwing gang signs. Dasani, now 16, knows that her estranged sister, Aviana, will be rankled by this. To write "forever family" is Dasani's way of saying the opposite, that nothing is forever, not even family, that one's sister can be replaced as easily as one's own blood, which is not thicker than water, as their mother used to say. In the photograph, Dasani wears a red bandana in allegiance to the Bloods. That's a gang. One family is poised to take the place of another. Dasani has not seen Aviana in over a year. They last exchanged texts 5 months ago. But Dasani knows how to break her sister's silence. Precisely 2 hours and 35 minutes after Dasani posts the "Forever Family" photo, Aviana appears on Facebook, clicking a digital hand. The hand waves at her sister. Dasani waves back. "Hey, sis," writes 15-year-old Aviana. A feverish correspondence follows. They agree to meet the following weekend at a subway station in Queens. They are both nervous. So Aviana sends detailed instructions. Dasani must take the A train to Broadway Junction, then the J train to Queens, to the last stop, get off, go upstairs, and then meet me at the turnstile. Queens is not Dasani's turf. She asks for the name of the station, which worries Aviana. Nothing can be left to chance. Instead, they settle on Broadway Junction, which is impossible to miss. "Got you, sis," Aviana writes. On the afternoon of December 10th, Aviana leaves her foster home in Queens, and Dasani leaves her foster home in Staten Island. They check their phones. "I'm on the train," writes Aviana. "Me too," writes Dasani. By 1:28 p.m., they are minutes apart. Both trains arrive, and the sisters dismount. They cannot find each other. Aviana writes that she is here. Dasani writes that she's coming upstairs. Aviana writes that she's coming down. "No," Dasani writes, "she's coming up." "Where are you at?" Dasani asks. "Aviana is at the turnstile." "Come to the escalators," writes Dasani. The thread stops. The station stops. Two sisters are crashing into each other. They have no words. They hold each other like refugees who have crossed an unseen border. Everyone is watching. "Mind your own damn business," Dasani manages to shout from her sister's impossible clutch. She cannot breathe like this. No one hugs like this. "You're holding me too tight. Let me go. Let me go." No one lets go. They stand like this for minutes. They already know their next move. The A train will come, taking them to downtown Brooklyn. The train is coming, the very train that their grandmother used to clean. It pulls into the station. The doors open.
Oh, I mean, it's just so lovely and so beautifully written. You know, this is the thing, that it is a book where the beauty of the prose is one of the things, one of the numerous pleasures that you get from it. And I wonder how important that was for you, because it's difficult, isn't it, that it needs to be beautifully written, but you also don't want it to be about you. And you don't want it to be about the style. And so how did you think about the voice with which you would tell Dasani's story?
I struggled with it for a long time. And in the early days, and I wrote this book over the course of those years and then rewrote. I don't consider myself a writer. I say I'm a rewriter. I rewrite and rewrite and rewrite until it starts to feel like it's hitting the right notes. I read my stuff aloud. And I read it to Dasani and to Aviana and to others as I was going. And sometimes they would say, I don't know, maybe it's more like it was this. Or, and I relied very heavily on video and audio, a lot of tech, which is ironic given I'm a complete Luddite myself, but I don't rely on memory. And so a lot of it was, you know, more than 100 hours of video recordings and dozens of hours of audio recordings to ensure that it was accurate. But at the same time, what I wanted, and I think this is where literary pursuits and journalism come together, is I wanted people to feel transported into the story, to feel moved by it, so much so that it, maybe it felt like fiction, but then they were constantly reminded it was real. And so they had to care about something that was really happening in this world. But the voice is hard, and I didn't want it to feel showy. My favorite writers are spare, and they're very economical, and they get out of the way of the story.
So maybe for our international audience, those who maybe don't know what's going on in New York City and really this crisis of homelessness there, maybe you could just situate the kind of social backdrop, the political backdrop, a little more for us.
Yes. There's a huge affordable housing crisis in the United States. Less than 3% of Americans have access to federal programs, the federal government's programs, that are things like public housing, Section 8 vouchers, the things that can enable you to live free of the stress of the rent burden, which is when so much of your income goes to paying the rent. And evictions have been a longstanding problem, of course. So we see homelessness taking different forms across the country. You've probably seen some of the news stories about the tent encampments in cities in California where the weather allows for that. In New York City, it's a little different because due to lawsuits over several decades, there is a right to shelter. And so people have a legal right to be sheltered, and the city must provide shelter if you can prove that you're homeless. And that creates, you know, a huge shelter system, but it also is not a friendly system. It's quite a punitive system. It's supposed to be temporary. And so in that system of hundreds of shelters, at the time that I met Dasani, there were over 22,000 children living in those shelters. I mean, that's the kind of crowd that would fill a football stadium, just to give you a visual. It's a huge population. And it's a very insecure life. It's a life of constant displacement, of being uprooted and put in another. One of the greatest descriptions I ever came across, it's actually in the book, was by an academic named Mindy Fullilove, who describes serial displacement as root shock. Mm-hmm. Is what happens mm-hmm. to a plant when you take it out of its root, pull it away from its roots and put it in new soil. Repeatedly, it experiences something called root shock. And I think that this is the kind of tragedy that we see unfolding with the homeless children in this country. Is everyone knows how stressful it is to move. So imagine just constantly having to move, constantly having to adjust to new sounds, smells, a different train station, a different classroom. Really hard to thrive in that environment.
Is there a sort of economic basis for this? I mean, it feels like this is something that is more serious now than it was. Is that because of house prices? Is it? But what is causing it to be so acute at this point in time?
I think it's been building for decades. You know, so the book walks through some of this history. I don't think it's a new problem. It is just. In fact, when I began looking for a child to write about, I wasn't looking for a homeless kid. I was looking for a poor kid, because I was stunned by the statistic that 1 in 5 children were growing up poor in America, which is one of the wealthiest, if not the wealthiest nation in the world. It's the superpower, one of the, you know, place that prides itself on, you know, on all the things that the American so-called dream is supposed to be about. Yet we have 1/5 of our future workforce growing up at such a disadvantage that they are way more likely to wind up incarcerated, pregnant as teens, dropping out of school, all of the markers that lead to really costly problems down the line. And so I was shocked by that, and I wanted to find a kid. And I started poking around, and I saw that there was this huge, it was like a buried news story that there were these 22,000 kids. It wasn't front and center. It wasn't. And to me, that was just also shocking. Like, well, why isn't this on the front page all the time? I mean, it's stunning. So I think it's the problem that's in plain sight that we all get used to. And in terms of economics, I mean, I think it is about the incredibly costly reality of housing and how hard it is for people to become homeowners when they don't have great wages or benefits in a country that, you know, where the livable, there isn't a livable wage for many working class folks. And so much goes to just staying housed. And that's a really tenuous situation.
So talk to me about when you found Dasani, when you decided it would be her story. And then this was first a series of newspaper articles that then expanded to become this incredible book.
So I started following Dasani and her family's life, which was a hard sell because it always is to immerse, to say, let me just be around you for I don't know how long, maybe a few months. I want to do a deep portrait of what it is to be struggling with these problems. Can you let me inside? Most sane people, and they were among them, would say no. Why would I allow my privacy to be invaded? But they read my work, and I'd been doing this for a long time, and in a community that they cared a lot about, which was the Muslim immigrant community in the United States. I had embedded in a mosque for 6 months. I had done a number of deep dives, as we call them. And I think they saw that I was serious and that it wasn't going to be a superficial treatment of their story. And they believed in the power and the importance of their story. And I think that that is, that does tend to be what convinces people a lot of the time to let you in, that they have something that's very, very valuable to society, that if they were to allow that story to be told, they could see potentially affect change. The series ran, and it did affect change. More than 400 children were removed by the city from substandard shelters, and those shelters were forever closed to children. So that was an immediate sign that, you know, their story had power. I just wanted to keep following them because what was clear to me, even though this was a 30,000 word, five-part series that constituted a pretty deep look by newspaper standards, to me, it was only scratching the surface, that there was so much more to learn by being with them about everything, about our nation's history, about the way that systemic racism plays out on the ground, about all these systems that they were interacting with and how those systems work. And also just about something that I know isn't of interest to you, Alex, because we've talked about this, but, you know, how do you define what thriving is? What does it mean to transcend?
Yes. And on whose terms, which I think is fascinating. So one of the things that I think is really important to recognize about this book is that Dasani is this just incredibly charismatic, vibrant figure, but that it is also the story of her family, and particularly, I think, the story of her mother, Chanel. And Chanel clearly warmed to you, and that became something, a relationship that was very important to you as you told the story. I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about how you came to gain that trust and to forge that closeness with Dasani's mother.
That was and remains a very important relationship to me because it was entirely about my desire as a reporter to illuminate her story, which didn't have a platform or an audience and deserved it. But it also became just an incredible human experience to encounter her, to know her world. She took me into her world almost in the beginning as a tour guide and never failed to make fun of me for all of my mistakes. I would drop my pen or she just thought I had the worst poker face she's ever seen in, you know, in the hood and on the street. You have to really, you know, just not show your emotions. Don't show what you're thinking. And Drea, you show it all on your face and you're ruining my street cred, and you don't even have street cred and now you're ruining mine. We had long conversations about street cred. And then when she wanted to throw me a compliment, she would say that my street cred was back up in the hood because everyone liked me, man. But I mean, I was this imposter. I was this outsider. And I think the thing that created a bond from the very beginning was the fact that despite all of our differences of, you know, class background, skin color, of just everything about our lives was so different, we were both moms. And I think, you know, she once at one point said to me, I wouldn't have let you near my children if you weren't a mother. But that is also precisely one of the things that became so challenging for me, because of course, any human would care so much about these kids being around them. And so to then go home to my very different reality, certainly, everything should be contextualized. I wasn't going home to a fancy apartment with a doorman. I was a renter. I'm married to a journalist, was married at that time to a journalist. And so in our own, everyone in New York, I think this even applies to the wealthy, feel that they don't have enough. It's one of those cities that never fails to make you feel like there's a better life just out of reach, every single person. But this is a family for whom everything was out of reach. And they were living right there in front of it because the wealth had come to their part of Brooklyn. And I think that that's what makes it a kind of, that is actually what's new about this story. When you look at the canon of works that I so admire and that have fueled me, Alex Kotlowitz's There Are No Children Here, about Chicago and the projects in the 80s, Adrienne Nicola Blanc's There Are Random Family, which is about the Bronx in the 90s, those were siloed communities where there had not yet been this return to the city that we're now seeing, not just in the United States, but all over. And this has, of course, happened in London as well, as the educated classes or upper class folks are trying to look for deals and they turn neighborhoods into something else. And the people who remain in those neighborhoods tend to be those who are there because they don't have to necessarily pay rent, so they don't get priced out. And so in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, what you see is these two massive public housing projects, and in the middle of them, this shelter. And that was Dasani's world, but it was just blocks from these townhouses that were selling for millions, and these fancy shops with boho chic clothing, and just the two worlds just right there in the same space. So Chanel was constantly curious. This was a conversation, not a one-way street. This was a dialogue where she would say something, I would respond, she would respond, and that's how I grew to learn more deeply about her, and was able to render her, I hope, as a very three-dimensional person in this book.
She's wonderful on the page, and you know, yes, she has. You can see where Dasani gets that charisma and drive. And what is her advice on how to get on in life is dress fly, do good in school, fight.
Which one, I of think,
one of the three. One of the three. Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if you could also just say a little bit about Supreme, who is, I wanted to read a parallel story that was much more focused in on him, because, you know, Chanel's struggle is extraordinary, but it's in some ways, Supreme, who is the husband, is dealing with so much himself, and my heart just bled for him and what he had to go through.
So Supreme, like Chanel and like many adults in this book, show us what it means to be adults walking around the world whom people easily disrespect because they're out of work or because they're homeless or because they struggle with addiction, when what those people who are judging them don't see is that Supreme and Chanel are former children. And those childhoods matter just as much as Dasani's in forming who they are. And I think he's actually, I would say, hands down, one of the most complex people, probably the most complex person I've ever had to try to write about. Every time I thought I'd figured out Supreme, he would surprise me. And he's just such a fascinating person on so many levels. This is a guy who had been in prison early. He'd been caught up in the war on drugs and landed a big sentence when he was 17, but they thought he was 18, and then educated himself and got a diploma from prison, came out, tried to reform himself, found that through religion, but also found it in this culture around his religion, which was the 5%, which is an offshoot of the Nation of Islam, and was very focused on, when I met him, I mean, part of the difficulty, of course, is so much of his ideology is to cast the white person as the devil and to its own form of just, it's he would say this, and he said this to me, it is black supremacy. If you talk about white supremacy, this was that black people were superior, and therefore anyone who's white, you can't trust. So he didn't actually speak to me, I think, for the first year, but he was a very curious and intellectually open and insatiable person. He was always reading, and he started reading my stuff, and it became of interest to him to engage in dialogue with me. And he then really participated deeply in this, even though he had, and what my skin color represented became a very vital part of the conversation and our histories and this nation's history and the divide. It became a really important vehicle for giving words to his story. And he read the book. He was very pleased with how carefully I grappled with these issues and tried to explain the different phases of his life. And at the same time, I think he's just a person who has suffered so much as a child, whose sister died in front of him and whose parents were addicted to heroin and who lost his family because of the same system and wound up very much lost, and then found a new life with his marriage to Chanel, Dasani's mother. And they kind of formed this new family that they wanted to create to repair the past. And yet the structural racism, which when he started to really cooperate and help me tell his story by filing Freedom of Information Acts and getting thousands of records to detail his encounter with various systems, we could actually show the kinds of ways that this plays out on the ground for someone like him, where even just cultural misunderstandings end up hurting him. For instance, it is common in his culture of the 5% to say the black man is God. And he would sometimes say, I am God. And there was an intake worker who decided that he was psychotic, that he actually believed he was God, versus understanding that this was actually just, he may believe that, but not because he's psychotic. It was a part of his belief system. And there's a literature behind it, and he quotes it. And I think there's a whole other book to be written about Supreme, and I have encouraged him to write it. I think he should write it.
I would read it. I would love it.
I would too.
Yeah. So you talk about sort of structural racism and the way it impacted on this family. You know, clearly George Floyd happened really just as you were finishing, I guess, the book. One of the things that I think is really both necessary and brilliant about the book is the way that you trace Dasani's heritage and the way that her chapter is just the latest chapter in a history of that kind of structural, of lives which are rendered difficult or impossible by the structures that are put around them. What changed for you in either the writing or the reception of the book, and particularly those passages after the events of 2020?
So it's so interesting that you zero in on this in this conversation. I'm very grateful for this question. From day one, Chanel and Supreme, eventually when he started to trust me and talk to me, but also Dasani and others, made it their greatest project to educate me in the what was then very much the unseen history of racism in this country. And of course, there's something I'd thought about and even, you know, grappled with in my own reporting before, but never deeply. And it was necessary with them. It was a very, very important thing to talk about it was like history was alive within them every moment of the day. We would pass a sign, or we would look at it. We were driving once past a neighborhood that had a colonial kind of architecture, one of the houses. And I remember Chanel saying, that looks like what a plantation would look like. It was just a constant, constant thing in, and something that I felt was so important to them. And as a journalist, you must follow where the story leads you, that I wanted to trace that history. In fact, Chanel would always talk about how she had red hair because it must have come from her enslaver. Well, who were her family's original enslavers? Who were they? And so that took me down the path of working with a genealogist. And for years, we were kind of just trying to figure out what this history was, to be able to tell it, because it was really important to them. And also, I think, to the story, to make it relevant to their current lives in the way that they felt it was relevant. And that history took me to Dasani's great-grandfather, June Sykes, who had fought in World War II. And his great-great-grandfather was a man named David, who had been born enslaved. And so we did locate that, we were able to be able to bring that to life and show how June got his ticket out of the Jim Crow South by going and fighting abroad, fighting the Nazis abroad, even though there was such deep segregation at home, and returned home and found himself unable to benefit from the things that white veterans were benefiting from, the ability to buy a home, to start a business with a loan. These avenues were closed off to Black veterans for the most part. And he was stuck in the projects. And you can then see how this sort of foundational, the roots of Dasani's poverty in that story, because so much of white wealth in this country is built on this intergenerational safety net that begins with the making of the middle class. And we were talking about real estate earlier, the ability for white Americans in the 40s to go to the suburbs, not be kept out by restrictive covenants, to go there and buy homes with loans and create wealth that would be passed down generations, to the point where today, the latest study I saw is that median wealth among white people in America is 10 times the amount that it is among Black Americans. And so this was a very, very important thing. And I think for me personally, it just got me really thinking all the time about the, even just the way in which my own skin color changed the outcome of certain things I was experiencing. I mean, this is a very personal thing, but I think before I started truly embedding in the life of Chanel, this Black mom with all of these kids who was constantly dealing with all these various systems, and standing in line with her, going to the emergency room with her, I didn't see this sort of unspoken privilege that I was experiencing as a mom in the emergency room with my child. My one of my two kids is very accident prone. She's broken bones skateboarding and doing other things. And her dad and I would go in the emergency room, and we were like reporters, you know, like boom, 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 asking all the questions that you ask because you want your kid to be okay. And are you getting that right x-rays? And starting in 2014, I started going into emergency rooms because that was medical care for Chanel. Somebody was having an asthma attack. That's where you went.
Yeah.
And what I saw was the added fear, the added layer of being a person of a sort of suspect. That's how she felt, because for her, as a Black woman, she was a target. The people in those emergency rooms, nurses and doctors, are mandated by law to report any suspicion of abuse or neglect. And so she had to answer all the right questions. She was the one answering questions, not asking them. And I think that kind of repeated exposure to this other reality is so important. I think it's what I hope people get from reading this book, is what that's like, just to be in her shoes. She always says, "Don't judge me unless you've walked a mile in my shoes."
Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
There are two things I wanted to pick up on from what you just said. The first is what seems to me one of the fundamental lessons that I took from the book, which was this distinction between abuse and neglect that seems to me so pernicious and so problematic. And such, you know, if I think about what I would like the world to learn from this, it is that those two things are very, very different. And yet they are elided hugely problematically by many of the agencies, particularly the ACS, that are tasked with looking after young people in America.
Yes, I think America historically has responded to poverty by separating children from their parents. We've seen this through time, but in its current manifestation, what it looks like in this system, which is the child protection system, which is a federally mandated system, but that plays out on the ground at the state and city level. So agency by agency, it sort of somewhat varies, but there's basically the same experience across America, which is that you as a parent can be accused of abuse or of neglect or sometimes both. Abuse, we know what that is. That's intention to harm. Neglect is about failure. It's about failing to provide. It's failure to provide adequate shelter, adequate clothing, adequate food. It is sometimes adequate supervision as well, because you might be struggling with alcoholism or drug addiction. The vast, vast majority of families that get caught up in the system are facing neglect accusations. And we know that so often the root of these problems that lead to neglect is poverty. And so there is this growing consensus that really it's the poverty of these families that's being criminalized. And it's also just astounding, because this is a system that does not provide parents with a reading of their rights, that has the unchecked power, for the most part, of removing a child from a parent's home. I can't imagine a kind of greater power in any context than that, than to remove a child. I mean, we know what that kind of trauma that brings. So to do that without due process, without a really strong system of due process, is just what's happening. And it happens again and again. And the year that Dasani and her siblings were removed from the home, 93% of the kids, thousands of kids in New York City who were in that system facing those accusations, were there just on neglect issues, not abuse. And yet there's this idea that in the foster care system, once they've been removed and put in foster care, it's because those kids needed to be saved because they were leaving horrible, abusive things. Not the case for most cases. So, and it's a population that is disproportionately Black or Brown. And so I think it's a really, really important major issue.
And then just the final thing, you know, there is a narrative for this book that maybe if I were a novelist writing it, I might follow. Dasani gets accepted into the Milton Hershey School, and it's an extraordinary opportunity for her. This is this private boarding school in Pennsylvania where she will have all sorts of opportunities open up to her. Were I writing it, because of the world I come from and what I conceive of as success, she would go there, she would do incredibly well, she would, you know, go on to great riches, etc., etc. That rags to riches, you know. I'm a cliche. We're preconditioned to follow those paths. She doesn't succeed there, and I don't think it's a spoiler for us to say that it doesn't go well for her.
It's one of the pivotal moments, right? Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, what actually the book does is to say, no, don't judge by your rules. Don't follow your own idea of what is best for her. Listen to her instead.
Yes. I think that if you were writing this as a novelist, I think you would have gone exactly in the direction that this went, because it's more interesting. This was not a cliche, what you said. What you articulated, Alex, was what Dasani herself hoped for when she went there. Of course she wanted something better. What she found when she was there was that she was being taught to speak differently and to behave differently in a way that made her feel like she had to choose between her culture, her family, her roots, all of which she's proud of, and this other America. And in that other America, you wind up in a different place geographically. You own a home, you have a thriving career. You get married, all the markers. You have no more than maybe three kids. It's all containable and sustainable. And you've arrived into the middle class, and you've departed. You've left behind this other world. We love those stories because they let us off the hook on sort of like, it's like, oh, thank God. You know what? If you just work hard enough, this is the American myth, I think. If you work hard enough, if you are talented enough, you can transcend anything. There are cases where this happens, and those stories should totally be celebrated. But we rarely ask ourselves why so many children who are just as capable and just as talented don't actually succeed in making it out. And I think that that's where this book turns the sort of traditional narrative of escaping poverty to some other place on its head, because we are forced to reckon with how much greater the barriers are than one child's potential. And also Dasani's own notion of success, which Hershey helped her figure out. Hey, I got some new skills there. I learned to be an excellent debater. I learned to feel confident in front of an audience of white people, so much so that this is not another spoiler. I can tell you, she got up in a courtroom towards the end of the book and made her own case for why she should be reunited with her mother. That I don't think would have happened had she not been practicing those very skills at Hershey. The thing is that she wants it both ways, and why shouldn't she have it both ways? She wants to be able to thrive, to transcend poverty, to succeed, but in her own cultural context. She doesn't want to have to leave. She wants success to come to her part of America, and she's working on it now. She's in college, and I'm sure people are going to ask more about her. So I'll let the questions happen. But
okay, lovely. Let's go to those questions from the audience. And the first one we've got is I think something you and I discussed when we first spoke, which is how do you tell these stories without the risk or opening yourself up perhaps to the accusation that you're exploiting them? How do you balance that very tricky moral situation?
It should always be on the mind of the journalist. I think that's number one. We need to be constantly wrestling with what our work is or isn't doing. And are we delving deeply enough? I think that it is about ultimately doing justice to the work, right? To the story that is before us, to grappling with it as deeply as possible, to reading as many books as you can in order. Sometimes I would read a whole book just to write a paragraph in this book. And I think exploitation is a kind of cursory treatment of a subject in service of some kind of escape that then benefits the person who told the story, but leaves the other people behind. And I think I've labored very hard against every single one of those things.
Yeah.
It is proof in itself. I think it's one of those things that, you know, the book itself stands sort of testimony as a response to any question, because it is such a deep work of being with, to use a Heideggerian term.
Thank you. Yes, you reminded me, because you had asked about George Floyd. The end of that story that I was telling earlier is when that happened, and there were periods, like years, where I would say to Chanel, I think this is fascinating. I'm glad we've gotten to the bottom of the story of your ancestors. I just hope someone reads this. To, oh my God, this has suddenly become a critical issue in American public discourse. So, and then it is fair to ask, and I think you did ask me this last time we spoke, you know, the question, and maybe someone else is asking, you know, what gives you, Andrea, the right to tell this story? And my feeling, my response to that is that I don't have the right to tell the story, that it is my duty to tell the story. It is not my right. It is my duty as a journalist, because what we're called to do as journalists is to tell the biggest stories of our day. And I think this is one of them. And yeah, everyone of every background should be on this story.
Do you think gentrification is a new form of segregation, or indeed an old form?
So if you think about the origins of that word, I believe it comes from a sociologist from the UK, actually. This is in my notes, so I'll have to look this up after. Her name escapes me, but she coined this decades ago, and the word itself comes from gentris, which one read of that word is of noble descent. So it does suggest that nobility has arrived. So right there you have divisiveness, whether it's class, race, usually both. I do think it has resulted for sure in segregation. We see this in New York City schools. We see this in housing. We see all kinds of division in American life along the lines of class and race.
Did you know at the start how long you were going to be with Dasani for? And I think this is a really good question. How did you know when it was time to write the book?
That's a great question. It's funny. I sort of wish I could have jumped into the future and been listening to this podcast in my former self a year or two in after the series had run. I had great moments of panic, of just feeling that this book is about everything. It felt like it was about so many things. It is about so many things. I think that looking back on those moments, that was the right thing to feel. And I think if we're not very nervous about complicated subjects that we are tasked or have decided to show up for and write about, then something's wrong. So I didn't feel ready to write for a few years because so many things just kept happening. And one thing I'll tell you is I did write the ending of this book on three different occasions, and all three endings are in the book. They're just chapter endings. The one I read at the beginning of this conversation was, I thought, the end in 2017, but then more kept happening, and it created, you know, deeper sort of new levels of understanding, or it beckoned me into new threads of history or policy. And I just felt that I had to keep going. And I did. It's not so much when did you know it was time to start writing so much as when did you know it was time to stop? And I think at a certain point, it just felt like if I didn't stop, the story wouldn't see the light of other readers of day, right? And so it needed to end. But I think you learn so much in the writing process. You learn what you don't know. So it's important to not wait too long, because as you write, you see the holes and you have to go back and try your best to fill them.
And the obvious one that follows on from that, which somebody has asked, but also, you know, I always want to ask, is how is Dasani doing now?
Dasani is on an upswing. This is what she says of herself. And she finally agreed to speak with for the BBC, which will be airing, I don't know when, but she has stayed very quiet because she's felt that she wasn't ready to speak. And so she's kind of been enjoying watching all of these events, and she'll probably watch this one. But her words to that person, and also just in general, are, you know, I'm doing the best I can, and there's ups and downs. My life has been a roller coaster all along, but it's a little less of a roller coaster now. She's the first person in her family to graduate from high school, the first to enroll in college. She wants to go into real estate. This is the latest interesting development. I find her fascinating. I will always find her fascinating. A homeless kid whose entire existence was defined by her lack of a home in the very beginning when I met her is now hell-bent on becoming an excellent realtor. And the way she put it was, I love looking at homes. I love seeing them empty and then seeing them filled. The floors, the sinks, and she's always been interested in that. This was part of the reason she loved the show Criminal Minds, was the crime scenes would show you these homes and these giant walk-in closets. And she would watch this show from her crammed room in the shelter, but she found it fascinating how other people lived. So wouldn't that be amazing if she actually brought that to fruition? And I believe she'll do whatever she sets her heart on.
Yeah. I mean, she's such a force. It's amazing. This is an interesting question. So is there something specific about New York to this story of child homelessness, or is it a universal story? And just to sort of follow up on that, I was describing the book to somebody, and I realized that the books that I reached for that it reminded me of were from very different places. So Stuart, A Life Backwards by Alexander Masters, which is wonderful, and then Catherine Boo's Behind the Beautiful Forevers, set in Mumbai. And so to me, that would suggest that this is a really universal theme that you're writing about. But obviously, there are things that are very specific to New York.
So what's specific to New York, aside from it being a city that everyone has, no matter where you are in the world, some sense of, it might have been a flicker of something from a movie, or it could have been one of the best trips or the worst trips of your life. It's a city that is, I think, emblematic in so many ways of different aspects of culture and experience and nationalities across the world. And in fact, everyone can be found to be living in New York. It's a global city. What's unique to it is the fact that there is this legal right to shelter. And so I think it allows us to see in a more concentrated way the experience of what it is for these homeless families to be living in this way versus in places where they don't have that benefit and therefore are more often doubled up. It's slightly less sort of in people's vision. It's
yeah,
unseen.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But I do think, and I love those books you mentioned, and I do think that what we're talking about when we're talking about housing insecurity, food insecurity, homelessness, is we're in a very general sense, we're talking about the idea of belonging. I think that's what this book is about at the end of the day. If you had to ask me how all of these themes interconnect, it's about who gets to belong to a place and who doesn't. And that place is a physical place. It's New York City, but it's also a metaphorical place that could be understood through politics, through economics, through social structures. It's a place in America that still feels different for people of color more than 50 years after the civil rights movement, more than 50 years after President LBJ declared a war on poverty, that still is a place of disadvantage. And So I think what Dasani wants is to feel that she belongs and that she's entitled to the same American dream that a lot of people take for granted.
This is an interestingly British question from James in Brighton. Is class taken seriously as an issue in American politics? Why is so much of the political conversation around cultural issues and not poverty?
So, wow, that is a great question. And I lived in the UK for a short time as a child, and I was struck by the clarity of the kind of class, lines of class, right? That there was a lot of discussion around class. And my mother's from Chile, same thing. So class focused. And I remember just many years ago, this was when I was a teen, believing that America was somewhat free of that, that this was a place that it was harder to define, you know, specific classes, that the mythology that you hear about America, that is, you know, ultimately a place of inherent meritocracy. What I think is clear is that it's a very polarized nation, and that a lot of the debates are driven by class divides, even if that's not at the forefront of the conversation. And it's interesting because when I set out to write this story, I felt a little bit nervous about the political conversation that does happen around poverty, because it is so centered on the adults. And it's always about either you're in the camp of it's their fault, they're lazy, whatever, let's blame them. Or you're in the camp of it's not their fault. This is very reductionist, but you know, it's structural racism, it's structural issues that lead to their problems. And so much of this is about assigning blame or relieving blame from these adults, when in the shadows of that conversation is this non-voting population. It's outside of politics, of children, that at the time it was 16 million children growing up poor in America, that I don't care where you land on the political spectrum, you have to face the fact that they exist and they aren't there because of a choice they made, or they just were there because that was the lot that they got dealt. And so my initial purpose was to focus on the children and write about a child for that very reason, to say, let's just look at what it is to be poor as a child and what you're up against. But the more I sort of dove into her after the series, dove into her story to write a book, the more I saw that the adults in her family are also former children, and those childhoods need to be understood, that this is a sequence of childhood experiences that are really, really important to grapple with when you're thinking about what's happened in America.
And then just finally and relatively swiftly, how did the pandemic impact the inequalities you write about in the book? Will the pandemic leave a lasting legacy on these people?
So a couple of interesting things to say about the pandemic is that it created relief programs that we have seen in studies that have come out have actually been very beneficial to children like Dasani. So one is this child tax credit that is just a basic income that has lifted on average about 3.5 million children out of poverty every month since it began, which tells you a lot, because studies of those families that are receiving that cash show that they're spending it on the right things. They're spending it on things like clothing and food and paying bills, and not on things like beer. So that's, I think, a very striking piece. Another thing that we saw happen was the eviction moratorium that paused evictions and brought the homeless numbers down in New York, so that we were around 15,000 kids in the fall. I think it's still hovering around there, versus 22,000 when Dasani was homeless. That moratorium in New York State has been lifted just now, a week ago. And I think we're going to see a return to a spike in numbers. And so I think that you see right there a lot. You learn a lot by looking at the impact of those two governmental interventions and how they have changed the lives in the interim of poor children.
Wonderful. Andrea, it's such a pleasure. The book is Invisible Child, Poverty, Survival and Hope. And you know, I'd like to leave the audience with something that I feel really strongly and really wanted to convey when I was writing about the book, which is that this could be a depressing story. It could be, there are parts of it that are distressing and upsetting, but it's also a very funny story. It's a very hopeful story. And you leave it full of hope for Dasani and for others alongside her and for, you know, humanity, that it is a book that I think left me feeling really good about the world, even though it's dealing with a really difficult set of circumstances. So I urge people to buy it and read it. It is one of the great books. And if you don't trust me, then trust Barack Obama, who I was delighted to see chosen as one of his books of the year. Andrea Elliott, thank you so much for your time and for writing such a wonderful book.
Thank you, Alex. It's been great.